Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've sent to me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have emailed to me at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. This is show number 75, and I can tell you for sure that when I first started doing this, I did not think that I would still be doing this, or I wondered, 75 episodes, that's a lot of questions. And I've tried hard not to repeat myself too much. I've had a couple mistakes and a couple repeats, but I think overall this is quite a body of information that has accumulated about Scientology and, you know, just about me and other things. But good times. I'm really enjoying this show, this video series on my channel. And I think you guys are too, so thanks for coming along for the ride. By the way, have some new designs up. I've been creating more on my Critical Merchandise site. So that is shirts, that's hats, that's mugs, that's all kinds of goofy stuff with different designs that I've created. So check it out. Link is below in the notes section. Critical Merchandise. So, by the way, I'm just going to get this out of the way real fast. I know this is shameless self-promotion, but you know, I've realized I've had a lot of new subscribers in the last year, and maybe you do and maybe you don't know that I wrote a book about Scientology. It's called Scientology A to Xenu, An Insider's Guide to What Scientology is Really All About. And I'm not going to, you know, plug it too much more here other than to say that it's not just a memoir. It is a critical analysis of Scientology. So there's also a link to that also in the notes below. So if you're interested in that, check it out on Amazon. It's available as an ebook, audiobook, and hard copy. And I still stand by it. It's a good piece of work, I think. So check it out if you haven't done so. So now let's get on with your questions. Monty Ollie, I was wondering if you could synopsize in plain English what exactly happened with the Monique Rathbun case in Texas. The legalese is very hard to understand, and I'm not sure why they dropped the case. And the Mott's 55. What do you think of Steve Mango's recent criticism of Marty Rathbun? Also, why do you think Monique stopped her lawsuit against the Church of Scientology? One post claims Marty is now defending David Miscavige. Things seem so bizarre. What are your insights? Okay, well, there's a lot to know and talk about in regards to this, so I'm going to synopsize this, okay? I don't want to spend forever on it. Marty Rathbun and his wife Monique, Marty Rathbun is an ex-Scientologist from the highest levels of Scientology. He was literally second in command under David Miscavige for a lengthy period of time. And he engaged in, while being in Scientology at that high level, he did, you know, some things that were pretty unsavory. We all did when we were in Scientology, so I'm not trying to single him out. But he was involved in very upper-level stuff, and so to an extent I don't even know. So he came out, and it was a real big deal when he came out of Scientology in the mid-2000s, and he started doing independent Scientology auditing of others from his house in Texas. He met Monique Rathbun, who was never a Scientologist. He met Monique, rather, and they got married, and she became Monique Rathbun. The Church of Scientology started stalking and harassing them because Marty was doing independent Scientology auditing, and David Miscavige didn't like that. And so they sent people out to his place. They called themselves Squirrel Busters. They had shirts. They were literally for months on end harassing and stalking the Rathbuns, and it was pretty ugly. And in fact, seeing video of that, because it was posted online, was one of the things that that I saw when I was still in that shocked me. I could not believe what I was seeing. It was nowhere in any Scientology issues that I had ever seen in all the years that I'd been in that made it okay to do what these squirrel busters were doing. It was unbelievable to me. And I knew in seeing it that it had to be a church-sanctioned operation. There was no way some random Scientologists were just going to get together and go stalk and harass Marty Rathbun. No way, right? So that really shocked me, and that was a real eye-opener for me when I was still in. Okay, so now, because of all that stalking and harassment, Monique Rathbun filed a lawsuit in Texas against the Church of Scientology to get them to stop. And that's really the bottom line, is she was just trying to get Scientology to stop doing that. And in the process of discovery and moving this thing forward, it never did get to trial. It was in discovery and pre-trial motions and all that sort of thing. During the course of that, the church did stop the harassment to a degree. I mean, they didn't have people standing outside their house with Squirrel Buster shirts, but there was evidence found that the church was still filming them. They had rented properties, you know, near their house and was spying on them still and this sort of thing. And Marty documented all of this. So they had this lawyer, this team of lawyers down in Texas, and they were suing the church, and things were moving along slowly, because any legal action against the Church of Scientology is going to move slowly. The church will engage in every single delay tactic they can, and anything and everything they can do to just chew up your time and money. So this was moving along, but the motions and the actions and the things that occurred while the trial was moving on were all mainly in Monique's favor. And it looked like there had been some appeals to, you know, by the judge, you know, various things had gone back and forth. But every time there was, you know, an appeal or every time there was a question, it looked like it was going in Monique's favor, and it looks like they had a very strong case. They even tried to get David Miscavige into the courtroom to depose him. And they didn't get the judge's agreement to order David Miscavige to appear in person, but they did get the judge to order that he had to submit a deposition in writing, and they were going to ask him questions, and he was going to submit his answers that way. Which never happened because the case got inexplicably dropped. The lawyers were fired, and Monique, you know, just dropped the case. And this left a lot of people scratching their heads. Nobody could really understand why. And there hasn't been a clear-cut statement from Marty on his blog or otherwise explaining why that was done. And there was, I believe there's been one or two insinuations that he can't necessarily give all the information as to why. I do not understand that particularly. I'm not saying that he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm saying I don't know what he's talking about. I can't understand why some statement couldn't be made that clearly in plain English explains why they decided to drop the case. But for whatever reason, they did. Certainly within their rights to do so. They're not under any obligation to explain themselves either. But it did leave great big question marks. And then Marty Rathbun has been posting blog articles basically criticizing or critical of the anti-Scientology community, as he calls it, ASC, he even has an abbreviation for it, the anti-Scientology community, basically accusing people who are speaking out against the church and critics of the church as being cult members themselves under, you know, Tony Ortega, who's a journalist. He's accused, you know, people who follow Tony Ortega as being part of a cyber cult. And he's sort of taken the anti-Scientology community that he was very much involved in and very much a part of, and is now calling them out and saying that they're bad people, or at least cult-like people, and making value judgments about them that of course, most people in the ex-Scientology community, whether they're ex-Scientologists themselves or people who follow or watch it because they're fascinated or interested in it, he started, you know, bad-mouthing them. And this has been even more inexplicable for a lot of people. I don't know why he's doing that. I got no idea. I watched Steve Mango's criticism of Marty. I watched the video that Steve Mango made. Marty, in addition to coming down on church critics like Tony Ortega, has also come down very hard in a recent blog article against Louis Theroux. Louis Theroux is a British documentarian. He has produced a movie called My Scientology Movie. Marty Rathbun plays a very significant role in that movie. Somewhere along the line, it appears, both from Steven's description and Marty's descriptions, that there was some kind of falling out or disagreement, or Marty saw that this production was not doing what he thought it was going to do. He got very upset by this. There were on-set arguments and yelling and screaming and this sort of thing, according to Stephen Mango. And so there was this big disagreement, and Marty has now been poo-pooing the movie itself and Louis Theroux and accusing them of various things. Which you can see on Marty's blog if you want to. and basically sort of decrying the movie and any sort of distancing himself from it. And Stephen Mango is saying, look, Marty was fully on board. He was there. Everything that happened happened because, you know, that's how he wanted it to happen. And so, you know, and then, but Stephen also described in detail that there were on set arguments, and Marty seemed to have this falling out with Louis Theroux. So that's all I know about that. I wasn't there. I wasn't involved in the production in any way. And I'm not, you know, privy to any back lines or hidden or, you know, secret communications about Marty. So I have to say that I simply don't know. And I have avoided getting involved in it or talking about it because of the fact that I don't know. And so any opinions I have about it are really kind of would be sort of, you know, it would be a little ridiculous to me for me to start forwarding, you know, any, I don't know, half-assed ideas I have as to why Marty has taken the actions that he's taken. I have no idea. So I'm not going to, you know, theorize on them here. I'm just going to fall back to the most three most important words I know in critical thinking, which is I don't know. So I will say, and I've said before, and this is not a new philosophy for me, it's something I've had from day one, is I've observed over the last couple of years since I got out of Scientology that there's some people who come out of Scientology who, you know, have a kind of, or there's upsets and things that occur between ex-Scientologists in the same way that there are upsets and disagreements and problems that occur in any human group, any group of people. Right? There are going to be, we don't all just get along. We don't all see things the same way. We don't all, you know, have the eye-to-eye thing on Scientology. Some of us come out of Scientology thinking that it was really good stuff, helped us a lot. Hubbard was a bad guy, or maybe it was all Miscavige's fault. And you get, you know, various shades of ideas, opinions, and attitudes about Scientology. And so we don't all share that same view. I don't know that there's any one view that all ex-Scientologists have, except that they don't want to be involved with the Church of Scientology formally for whatever reason. All of those reasons are multivaried, right? So therefore, when, you know, looking at how do you talk about the church? What do you think about the church? What do you think about recovering from the Church of Scientology and your experience there? Different ideas, different attitudes about it, and sometimes these different ideas result in real conflicts. People get really passionate about this, and there have been some pretty, you know, hardcore fights that have gone on through through message boards, through Facebook, through blogs, and you know, telephone conversations and whatnot. And some of these things are a bit more spectacular than others. I try not to involve myself in that. My idea is that the Church of Scientology is a big enough foe or opponent all by itself for us to direct our attention on and to expose the lies and corruption and nonsense that goes on in Scientology so that we can educate people to avoid it like the plague. That's pretty much the only reason I'm talking about it. And, you know, I love to, you know, try to get people out of it who are in it, and if my work has done that, and it has, then I consider it successful. And I try to warn people off of it, and my work has successfully done that too. So that's why I'm doing this, and I'm not doing it to fight other people. I don't want to get engaged in conflict with other critics because I'm not here to be involved in conflicts with other critics. To me, everybody's got their own views and their own ideas. They have a right to their own views and ideas. And I might, like I do with pretty much how I feel about anything when it comes to ideas, I have a right to look at somebody else's ideas and criticize or critique or analyze or ridicule those ideas. That's not necessarily the same thing as ridiculing or criticizing the individual, right? There's an idea and there's the individual, and they are two different things. And I try to, you know, try to put that gap there and look at the idea, you know, not the person. So that's been my mode of operation on this, and that's why you haven't seen me talking about this conflict or other conflicts between critics, because I, you know, it's not my thing. Not at all what I want to do or what I'm about. And that is pretty much everything I have to say about that, so there you go. Stephen Willis. I understand Hubbard wrote that about 2% of the population were essentially degraded beings. However, did he define all of these people as SPs, or is this term reserved just for enemies, perceived or otherwise, of Scientology? Or am I wrong altogether, and is the title SP reserved just for somebody such as yourself, who at some point has been specifically scheduled by the church? Okay, well, let me tell you what I know about these two terms, degraded beings, or DBs, and suppressive persons, or SPs. Two different things. Hubbard has written a couple issues. I think one was called Alter Is and Degraded Beings. Alter is a Scientology term. We won't get into that right now. But in this issue, he talked about how a certain percentage of the population were degraded beings, and they were going to remain degraded beings until they got up through OT level 3, which is the Xenu stuff. Up until they got through that section of the bridge, they were going to be low class, low case, degraded beings. They were just people who, you know, were very much victims of that whole Xenu incident and were so bad off that they just, you know, with their body thetans and all that all the time. Of course, in that issue, he didn't talk about body thetans because it's not a confidential issue. And all the body thetan stuff is very confidential and hush-hush. That is very different from a suppressive person. Okay, so here you have this class of people who are just screwed up. And Hubbard called them degraded beings. And he also referred to or used the term degraded beings to describe people who join the Sea Org and then leave it. Because they can't cut it, right? They couldn't cut the mustard. They weren't good enough. They couldn't deal with the responsibility and the harsh discipline or whatever. And so out they go. And he'd let them go, but he said, those guys are DBs, or degraded beings. Nice labeling for everybody who didn't want to go along with his little army or navy. So that is an issue that Hubbard talks about. And that's a policy letter called Sea Org Resignations, where he says that. So then, that's a whole different concept from a suppressive person. A suppressive person is the antisocial personality. It's the merchant of chaos. It's the person who is kind of like loopy and is operating on the principle that that he has to get everybody before they get him, right? Hubbard said he operated in fear, that they're actually afraid of everybody else and that they are stuck in some incident from long, long ago in the past. This was Hubbard's technical explanation for a suppressive person, is that the person was going along in life and he got stuck in some incident, some horrible things, like a battle, let's say, where he's, you know, charging over the hill and there's all these muskets and he gets shot and stabbed and killed horribly and all that. But there's this stuck picture, there's this stuck aspect to it where the person as a spiritual being is now stuck seeing the world through this filter of this incident that occurred to them. And everybody that they see is filtered through this picture where they're enemies to this person, right? To the suppressive person. The suppressive person sees everybody and anybody around him as an enemy or potential enemy, and therefore is operating on the idea that he has to do them before they do him. And so this is where evil is born and this sort of thing, right? Where you have these people who, because they're suppressive people, Hubbard lists out these characteristics to them, like they can't get things done very easily. They're always selecting he calls it the wrong target. The example he gives is if the tire is flat on his car, he'll kick the cat in anger and frustration. And that's, you know, he should be handling the car, but he's kicking the cat, right? He's just selecting the wrong target all the time. And they speak in generalities, right? Everybody says, everybody knows this. You know, well, you know what they say about you, you know, and this is how they talk. They do not respond to help, or mental help or therapy or treatment. They don't respond to it. And Hubbard said that there was only a couple of very precise auditing actions he had developed which would actually handle this stuck picture, stuck incident, and get them unsuppressive. But Hubbard then said later on, yeah, I've discovered how to do that, but you know what, these are such bad people. I mean, we're talking about the psychopaths of society, that why would we go out of our way to try to help them? Screw them, right, basically. So that's how he refers to and talks about SPs. And of course, the church has used the suppressive person policy to ostracize and get rid of, sequester and kick out political dissidents. Like, they've used it politically to get rid of people who are critical of the church or its leaders. That Hubbard started that, Miscavige has continued it, amped it up even. And so anybody who now, a suppressive person, is pretty much anybody who speaks out against the church or tries to stop Scientology in some way. That's how Scientologists see it, by the way, is they don't look at people who speak out against the church and go, oh, you got a good point there. Or, gee, wow, I hadn't really thought about, wow, yeah. I mean, David Miscavige really does wear all those expensive clothes. He's a Sea Org member. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. So they don't look at it that way. They look at it as you're criticizing the church or you're criticizing the church's leaders, and therefore your goal in doing that is to try to stop Scientology, and therefore you're suppressive. You're a suppressive person, right? It could never be that you're doing this, you're criticizing the church or trying to correct its errors or something. It could never be that you're trying to do this because you're legitimately trying to make the place better. It's always about how you're trying to stop Scientology, and that's how they interpret it. And so that's why you get declared a suppressive person and kicked out, which is what happened to me. So that's the difference between those terms. Manny from Tampa. Hi, Chris. Was sitting one day at the Spaghetti Warehouse for lunch in Tampa, looked out the window and noticed the Scientology org. I had no idea it was there. I was there for about an hour having lunch and noticed a security guard come out like every 15 minutes looking around, checking garbage cans, etc. What exactly are the guards looking for? What are the duties? Are the guards Scientologists? Okay, at the Tampa org, which is a local Class 5 org, so it's not a Sea Org installation, although it's very close to Clearwater, so Sea Org members, I'm sure, go over there all the time. But what you're looking at a Class 5 level when you're looking at a security guard is you're looking at somebody who is just protecting the grounds, okay? And I understand that security has been hired in some instances with churches. If they feel that there is some temporary local threat, they'll bring in some security. I've seen that literally only a couple times in all the years that I was in. It's not a common practice by any stretch. But I'm suspecting, although I don't have enough information from your question to be able to tell for sure, but I'm suspecting that was the case. And maybe there was some threat or thought of a threat against the Tampa church, and so they had these security guards. Now, if it was a staff member, like a church staff member, not Sea Org, then you have somebody who works in a part of the church called HCO, the Hubbard Communications Office, and that's the division of the org that works on hiring and firing and personnel and also works on ethics and justice, right, and any kind of ethics and justice actions. And if Scientologists get in trouble or something like that in that area, that's where they would go, is to the HCO there. And perhaps you were seeing a person in the ethics section, because that's where security guards would be, if there were, such. I've never, ever seen a single posted security guard in an org. I've never seen that post or that job. But that is where they would be if they did have such a person on post. And that person's job would be to, make sure the grounds are secure and there's no bombs in the trash cans and stuff like that. It's the only thing I can imagine as to the scenario that you're presenting, because security guards are not a commonly seen thing at a local city church. On a Sea Org base, you definitely have a security contingent. And you have Sea Org members whose jobs are to be security guards. That's their job. And like in Los Angeles, you'll see videos of these guys. They dress in uniforms. They have stars. They, sometimes carry weapons, ride around on bikes, patrolling the area. And those are legitimate, true blue Scientology Sea Organization security guards. Their job is to keep an eye on the grounds and secure the base and secure the perimeter, but they also have an additional duty of going around and patrolling and looking into and checking up on the staff, the Sea Org staff, on the base. And they'll go around with clipboards and inspection sheets, and they'll do interviews with people on their job if they're not doing good, and they will check things out and make sure that person's, you know, on schedule, going to study, all this kind of stuff, which is a total joke in the Sea Org because everybody's off schedule because they're working insane hours. And study is optional as far as, like, sometimes it's enforced and sometimes it's not. And if you got 3 hours sleep the night before, you're not in shape to go study. So, you know, these questionnaires, you know, anybody can be gotten into trouble with these things because, you know, the Sea Org's whole schedule and lifestyle prevents, you know, the standard nice routine schedule that's supposed to be the case with the Sea Org, right? The Sea Org are supposed to be on these very regimented schedules, but those schedules are always, you know, the first thing they go in the trash can when, you know, the latest emergency comes down the line. So anyway, that's what the security guards go around and do, is they protect the perimeter, and they also inspect and report on the staff and keep an eye on the staff. And there's a lot of cameras, for example, that are kept in a control room in security. There's a whole wall of monitors, and these cameras are from cameras all over the base, including inside the base, like in the berthing areas, not in rooms, but in the hallways of the berthing areas, and in the hallways and by the dining room and the canteen and this sort of thing. So they can keep an eye internally and make sure no staff are sneaking off to their rooms in the middle of the day and this kind of thing, right? This is also a job they have. So that's the security role in Scientology. J.E. Steiner, I don't understand what everyone on staff and in the Sea Org is so busy with. I hear stories of people working 16-hour days, 7 days a week, and I believe them, but what is there to do in Scientology? It seems that with very few people coming into the religion/business, that the only work to be done is regging current members and maintaining the orgs and other real estate owned by the church. Well, I think I've answered a question like this, you know, maybe months and months ago, so I'll just pick this up again. There's a lot of different things that are to be done in a Church of Scientology. It's broken up by divisions. So you have hiring and firing, you have reception, you have the ethics and justice, right? You have the guys running around that I just described. You have the whole regging area, which includes a bookstore, selling books, selling lectures, that sort of thing, as well as selling services. And that's the mainline money inflow to the church. So of course there's going to be people there. You have a whole treasury division in every church, and that's the guy who's keeping the accountant straight, right? Paying the bills, getting the money in, paying the staff when they have whatever little, you know, modicum of money, little bit of money to hand out. They're the guys who do that, right? And they keep all the accounts straight and all that sort of thing because they have bank accounts and, you know, that sort of thing. It's not just like they have one checking account. They have multiple accounts. And then there's audits, keeping up on the audits, you know, for the IRS, you know, that sort of thing. So that's treasury. Then you have the technical division, the production division, which is where all the classes are delivered and the auditing and counseling is delivered. And people are called who have paid for services but haven't come in and started them or done them. You know, maybe some guy signed up for a package of five courses and he did the first one. And then he left and he never came back and did the other four. So they'll be trying to call him and get him to come in and do those courses, right? You know, handling that backlog of undelivered services. So that's the Division 4 area. Then you have Division 5, which is qualifications, which is where when people finish actions, they certify that they're done and attest to having completed them and having gotten something out of it. Division 5 is also the part of the organization that trains the staff. And if the staff are getting any training or getting any auditing, that's where it's supposed to be happening, although most often it occurs in Division 4. And QUAL is also supposed to be the corrective division, the area which goes around and inspects how staff are doing, not to get them in trouble, but to correct them if they're doing their job wrong or they don't know what they're doing, right? So that's what QUAL is supposed to do. Then you have three more divisions under the umbrella of Division 6, or the public divisions. And you have public contact, you have public servicing, and you have field control. And public contact is, you know, going out and doing the stress tests and the personality tests and trying to get people to come in. And that's, so there's a whole division that does nothing but that work, if there's anybody posted there. Then you have public services, which is the introductory services and beginning services. Not the hardcore stuff that's done in Division 4, but the new stuff. If you go into a church and you sign up for a communications course, that's where you're going to do it, is in Division 6B, in public servicing. And when you do enough services in 6B that you graduate up to being a real Scientologist, then you go into Division 4. And then you have field control, which is the division that's responsible for establishing social betterment activities like Way to Happiness and Narconon and Criminon and all that kind of stuff. And also that's the part of the organization that deals with the field, the existing number of Scientologists in an area, and tries to get them to bring more people in and disseminate Scientology, tell their friends and family about it, that sort of thing. So there's this whole gamut. Oh, and then there's the executive division, of course, which is the execs, the people who run the organization. So, this is the big picture of a Scientology organization, and all of these things need to be done if the organization is going to be at all successful and keep its doors open. So there's a lot of work to be done in all those different areas. There's a lot of letter writing that gets done too. There's a lot of calls that get made to get people to come in because, you know, these churches are pretty empty, and they're desperately trying to get people in, so the majority of their time is spent calling people in and trying to get them to come in and do their services that they paid for, and get them, of course, when they come in, to pay for more services. So that's kind of the overview of it. And you can get really involved in a lot of busy work in any one of these areas, organizing it up and handling all the files and making calls. And then, of course, when people come in, they do need to be serviced. Somebody has to see that the person gets through his classes, or somebody has to counsel that person, right? And that there's a whole process to all that. So that's all. That's the regular, usual work that gets done in a church. Kiva Go. Hey, Chris, do you remember the record-breaking extreme examples while you were in of the most number of people calling someone to confirm they're attending an event? Ross and Carrie's podcast revealed they experienced multiple calls per day. Also, any examples of extremes on the other end, like most number of years someone wasn't active that you recovered? We're seeing letters from a Church of Scientology registrar being posted online that were sent to people 23 and 48 years after they bought a book. Okay, as far as event calling goes, I've seen some pretty crazy examples. I remember one day there was a guy who was hanging up on people because he had been called by 7 different people within like an hour or two on the same day. Hey, you coming to the event? You know, yeah, I'm coming, you know. And then like 10 minutes later, hey, you coming to the event? And it was like, yeah, you guys just called me, you know. And there were a lot of efforts being made because the staff hated doing this to people. You know, there's a lot of pressure on the staff to get them to do this work. But staff are people too, and they recognize that it really sucks when they have to like get an earful because of their own inefficiency, they're sitting around a table calling the same guys over and over again. And they don't like that, you know, any more than anybody else does. So, but they do it anyway because they don't have anything else to do. And they got to get those event confirms, you know? So I've seen 7-8 times, you know, a guy get called by 7 or 8 different people in the same day. And as far as getting people back in, you could recover people who've been gone a long time. You know, I actually got people back into the church when I was going around knocking door to door and finding people who had done Scientology in the past and trying to get them to come back in. I contacted people who hadn't been in a church since the 70s. And I don't think I ever reached anybody all the way back to the 60s. Although there are names and there were people that we were trying to get who had been back last on Scientology back then. And Hubbard's policies say, look, if they did it then, they'll do it again. You just have to get them recovered. You know, you got to get them back in. So that is how, that's kind of some of what I saw when I was doing that kind of work. Whoa, flash answers time. Benjamin Johnson, do you agree that the church is facing a demographic time bomb? All the PR emails for small church events show nothing but ART members. Gray hair and bald heads dominate the scene. Generation X and millennials are just too internet savvy to be routed onto the lines. Did you see an older membership in the Twin Cities, etc.? Do you think that COB should start selling gilded urns and caskets? Thanks for your great work. Yeah, I think they might want to get into the casket business, actually. there is a demographic problem in Scientology. There definitely is. Back in the 70s and 80s, they were known for being hip, cool, getting a lot of college people, college-aged folks in. I got into Scientology when I was a teenager, and I met a lot of people who did. Of course, now, you know, they're 20, 30 years older than that. And there is a lot of gray hair in Scientology. About the only younger people that you see in Scientology are their kids or their kids' kids. And they're definitely, you know, as a result of that. Jenna Pett, often when Scientologists and ex-Scientologists talk about why they disconnected from someone or why they didn't look at anything critical about the church, etc., they often say it's because they didn't want to lose their eternity. What is this eternity they're at risk of losing? What long-lasting consequence do they believe will befall them if they fall out with the church in this life? Look, this is real easy. People get into Scientology, and the number one hook for them staying in Scientology is they are going to achieve personal spiritual immortality and personal freedom, which is what they use as their eternity. They use this phrase, you know, it's my eternity. It's my life into the future in an infinite, you know, for an infinite number of years. They think that's what Scientology is going to give them, is it's going to rehabilitate them spiritually to where they'll understand and have full awareness of their own spiritual capabilities and potentials. That's why they're doing Scientology, and that's why they pay almost any amount of money to continue doing Scientology, and why they put up with so much bullshit in continuing with Scientology is because this is the reward they think they're getting. And they think they're getting it in spades. They really think this is what they're making all these sacrifices for. And of course, you know, it's all a hoax and a lie because there is no OTs, there are no clears, there's no, you know, these things don't exist as actual states of existence as described in the materials of Dianetics and Scientology. No one, you know, can even prove a reactive mind exists, but even if it did, no one has shown any of the demonstrable results that are supposed to be there from having gotten rid of it, much less show the demonstrable evidence of being more spiritually aware. You know, it's all subjective nonsense. So, there you go. Laura S., you've had some awesome guests on your show. Lloyd Evans, the man who puts out excellent content about the Jehovah's Witnesses, has collaborated with you. Thanks for introducing me to his channel. Of course, everyone can't help but love Tori Magoo 44. What other YouTube channels do you personally enjoy? Whose work do you follow in your free time? Well, I've been looking at a lot of stuff, especially more so lately than I was, you know, a year or so ago. I have a list of recommended channels actually on my YouTube channel, so check out those related channels. But, you know, there's Karen Delacarriere's, there's, you know, Tony Ortega posts videos from time to time, but that's mainly just stuff from his blog. I'm very interested in philosophy, science, critical thinking, and rationality. So I, you know, follow Sam Harris. I've got Kevin LaPlante, who is a person I just interviewed for my podcast this week. If you haven't watched that, you really need to, because Kevin is awesome. And we talk about some really, really, really good stuff in terms of critical thinking and rationality and stuff, and not in some dry academic way either. So he's really good. And I've got a lot of interests. I also follow a lot of movie channels, movie reviews, things like that. And also I follow a lot of channels that talk about, you know, how to do YouTube and how to do videos and how to do that kind of work. So there's Video Creators and Film Riot and you know, those kind of channels. I love Chris Stuckman's movie reviews. So So I follow that kind of stuff, you know. I've watched a lot of other atheist videos, other channels, the Thinking Atheist, you know, the Friendly Atheist, those channels are, I kind of dig. I'm not so much into the Amazing Atheist or Thunderfoot. I think they're a bit harsh. So I don't really follow them. I see some of their videos from time to time. I used to follow a guy named Steve Shives. I loved him until he went way too extremist left for me. He just kind of went way off base, and so I couldn't really follow him anymore. But that's who I follow. Okay, and so we've reached the end of another episode. I hope you found these answers interesting and informative and entertaining. And again, check out the critical merchandise. Check out my book. Definitely check out my podcast. I know that I put up a lot of work. I know I'm very prolific, and it's hard to keep up, I'm told, with all my content all the time. And so I don't necessarily expect that everybody's going to see everything. But I'm really putting a lot of work into my podcast these days, and I really hope that you guys will check that out, because it's there for you guys. And especially even on topics you might not necessarily think that you're so interested in, those are the ones that I want you to watch the most, because I think there are things of interest in them. So anyway, you'll be seeing a lot more stuff coming out on the podcast line. And you know, as well, of course, as some Scientology-centric content as well. So anyway, thanks a lot for watching. Thanks for hanging on here, and I will see you guys next week.